it's amazing how many topics of the Bible end up relating to each other. There were some things mentioned that I might mention again. But anyway, this evening, I greet you in the name of the one who laid aside his immortality and took on mortality so that us mortals could someday take on immortality. Being mortal. The word mortal simply means being subject to death. Having a life that's not lasting or permanent. That's what mortality is. So Jesus came to earth so that us who are subject to death, mortal, through the curse of sin, could again be brought into a state of immortality, a state where death would have no longer have its effect on us. As we look at the message for tonight, it would be interesting to know what you expect. When I first was assigned this, there was actually a book written that by this same title, and so I thought, well, you have a book to read. This shouldn't be too hard. But the more I looked at the idea of the challenge of the considering that we're all going to die sometime, the more challenging it became. But I hope as we look at this that it will help us to realize, understand, and accept the fact that we indeed are mortal, that someday we will most likely pass on, we will die, these bodies will die, and hopefully that will affect the decisions we make in life and how we live our life. I've divided the message into four parts, four headings tonight. For heading number one, I simply entitled it An Overview of Mortality. And I have several points under that part one. Number one, I wrote, we enter life believing that we are immortal. Now, before you get too excited about that, let me explain what I mean. For some reason unknown to us, God does not give us memory before our birth. We don't remember being born. We don't remember anything before we were born. And even after we're born, they say it's probably around the two-year-old mark till we begin to, in our awareness of life, begin to store memory. We begin to realize what's going on around us to the point where it becomes a part of us. And so before that, we know nothing. And as that awareness comes upon us, we only realize life. We don't realize death. We have no connection to death. We have no way of comprehending death because our only realization is life. And so I believe that kind of builds into us a tendency to think that death, what's that? Well, it'll never happen to me, or at least very unlikely. And we'll talk some more about that. Plus, I believe we enter life kind of with an expectancy. We continue as children, we continue to look forward to things. Let me explain that. We all know what it's like to be told or tell your children, no, you can't do that, you're not big enough yet. All right? You can't go with daddy on the tractor because you're not big enough. You can't go to school until you are 6. You can't drive the lawnmower until you're 8. You can go along hunting when you're 12, and you can drive when you're 16, and so on and so on. And it builds into us an expectancy that life is ahead of us, okay? That life is getting better. It lays before us. And it doesn't introduce us to the thought of dying. And so we kind of have this mindset that life is just going to go on. Open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Solomon has a lot to say about mortality, about life, and how we look at it, how it should be looked at. And we don't have time to look at everything he says. But if you open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, I'd like you to just read verses 1 and 2, and then verses 10 and 11. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 1 and 2. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up that which was planted. Now let's skip down to verse 10. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he has set the world in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Now here in verses 1 and 2, notice that he tells us, for everyone and for everything, there's a time to be born and there's a time to die. And then in verses 10 and 11, we talk about mortality, this thing of dying, but I also mentioned that we tend to feel we're immortal. Well, notice verse, I believe this passage here brings that thought out. It's not just a conception that we kind of get as we go along. It also comes from God, because in verse 11, if you look at that verse there, I'm going to read that verse again using some words from my center column reference. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has set eternity in their heart. He has set eternity in their heart, except that no man can find out the work that God does from the beginning to the end. So I believe the concept of immortality is actually given to us by God. He's implanted a measure of eternal perspective in our spirit or in our heart. And only a measure, because it tells us here that it's not a complete perception of eternity, because we still don't understand God. God is eternal, and we don't completely understand him, and that's okay because he's God. But I believe the challenge that we're looking at tonight is the fact that we do have an eternal, an immortal part of us living in a mortal body. And we somehow find it easy to keep those connected. It's easiest if we just figure it's all immortal or all all either immortal or mortal, even though that's not exactly as it is. And as we get older, some of you can attest to that, we know the fact that these bodies aren't going to last forever. As you go down the stream of life, it becomes apparent. So the question came to my mind, how do you look at this subject? Do you look at it from the standpoint of a young person, a middle-aged person, or an older person? Can we look at it in a way that makes sense to everyone? Is age the only determining factor in our comprehension of mortality? Well, that brings us to point number 2, which I have: realizing our mortality will make a difference in how we view and live our lives. I'd like to draw your attention to a story about a girl in her early 20s that was involved in a very bad traffic accident, practically almost lost her life. And when she woke up, she was in a hospital room with 4 elderly women. And as she lay there, hanging between life and death, the women in her room were all elderly women who had fallen and broken their hips. That's something that's very common with elderly. And as she lay there and she viewed those elderly women and herself, she realized that at that point in her life, she was viewing life a lot more like those old women than the 20-year-old girl she actually was, because of where she found herself and because of the condition she found herself in. And so she became aware that how we choose to spend our lives is dependent on how much life we perceive ourselves to have left, rather than on what our age would suggest we have left. See, it's all perception. It's about perception. So if she's correct in that from her vantage point, having come so close to death, she began to realize that she was looking at death much differently than she had right before that experience, or looking at life, I should say. And so it's very important that we have the right perspective about life, because none of us are guaranteed to get to old age, see. So there was no guarantee at her situation. It looked like she might not even get old. And so her perception of life changed. Turn to Psalm 90. And I believe here is where Moses wrote this psalm. And here Moses brings out some of these very thoughts. About how we perceive life. This passage was written in relation to when the children of Israel were in the wilderness. But I believe we can learn some things from it as well. Psalm chapter 90 is not a long chapter. I'm going to read it and just listen as he talks about life and death. Verse 1, Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hadst formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Thou turnest man to destruction and sayest, return, ye children of men. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday, when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest them away as with a flood, they are as asleep. In the morning they are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up, in the evening it is cut down and it withereth. For we are consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath are we troubled. Thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. For all our days are passed away in thy wrath. We spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 80 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength, labor, and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. Who knoweth the power of thine anger? Even according to thy fear, so is thy wrath. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. Return, O Lord, how long? And let it repent thee concerning thy servants. O satisfy us early with thy mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days wherein thou hast afflicted us, and the years wherein we have seen evil. Let thy work appear unto thy servants, and thy glory unto their children. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it. Now notice here verse 12. Moses says, teach us to number our days. And I had to think of Psalm 39, where David says, Lord, make me to know mine end and the measure of my days, what it is, that I may know how frail I am. I found it interesting that both Moses and David saw a need in their life to have God teach them what life is all about. Teach me how frail I am. Teach me about this thing of being mortal. Make me to understand. I believe they realized that it's so easy to have a faulty concept about life and what it is. And I believe their prayer was, help me to have the wisdom to know how to use the days that I have in the right way—the way that you want me to. I don't think how most people reject the idea, or they don't want to think about how frail they am. But I believe David understood that really, when it's all said and done, we really are very frail, and he wanted to understand that. And I believe the reason he wanted to understand that was because he wanted to live his life with no regrets. Back in Psalm 90 again, verse 14, Moses says, satisfy us early with thy mercy. I like that. Father, teach us early in life to accept your mercy and a relationship with you, because it's so important about how we're going to live our life. It's important that we understand life. Satisfy us early with thy mercy. Whether our lives be long or short, let's find God early in life. And that brings me to point number 3. Finding fulfillment in mortal life is only possible through a connection with our Creator. Turning your Bibles to the New Testament, to Acts chapter 17. And this, I had to think of that little lesson we had about God being the center of life. Paul here is talking and made me think of this passage. Acts chapter 17 is the story when Paul was in Athens. And as he came there, this city had all kinds of idols and gods. And he found an altar that said, to the unknown God. And he said, well, he wants to explain to these people the one God they don't know yet. And we're just going to read part of his message there. Acts chapter 17, I'd like to read verses 24 to 28. Paul speaking here. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed, and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not very far from every one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of our own poets have said, for we are also his offspring. Now notice here in verse 25 that Paul acknowledges that God is the giver of life and breath and all things. That idea was already alluded to this evening. But then in verse 27, as he recognizes that fact, he tells us the reason that God has us here. Look at verse 27, because I believe that God has put man on the earth because he wants to see how many men will seek after him. He says, if haply they might feel after him and find him. And in that, he means in the hope that they will find him. God has this hope that as he put mankind on the earth, what he wants man to do is turn back to him and find him. And Paul says that God is not very far from us. It almost sounds like even if you're blind, you can just reach out and feel him, and God is right there. God is not hard to find. And why shouldn't we find God? Why shouldn't we want a relationship with him? Paul says it's in him that we live and move and have our being. I believe that our moral life is wasted unless we have a connection with God. I believe back in Psalm 90, we again referring back to Moses' words, he sensed this same thing because he prayed, "Establish thou the work of our hands, establish thou the work of our hands upon us, yea, the work of our hands, establish thou it." He realized that life would be wasted unless God was a part of it. And I believe that many a person is living their mortal life for themselves. And their theology is that I have to get out of life what I can because when it's over, it's over. Moses, on the other hand, saw the need for God's blessings on our efforts so that they would carry on after we are gone. Back there in Ecclesiastes, I mentioned already that God put eternity in the human heart. And I had to think how when a person lives life for themselves, selfishly, that eternal perspective is lost. Because when the person dies, that's the end of it. All they did was for themselves, and that's the end of it. But when a life is lived in service for God and blesses others, then when that person leaves, that blessing goes on. And indeed, that blessing can go on into eternity, because only in eternity will we realize all the good that individuals have done, all the impact that their life had on others. So mortal life is fulfilling only when lived with a relationship with God. Well, that brings us to part number two. And that part I've entitled, "The Realities of Aging in Our World Today." What's reality about aging? Well, I sure can't tell you all that's reality, but number one, I have life expectancy. Remember that word. Life expectancy has gone up. Listen to these figures. In 1950, the global average lifespan around the globe, the average lifespan was 46 years old. In 2015, it was 71 years old. So in 65 years, the average life expectancy around the globe increased by 25 years thanks to better sanitation, better nutrition, and better medical knowledge and practices. Now in America, the difference wasn't quite as great. In 1950, the average lifespan in America was 68 years old. In 2015, it was 79. So in those 65 years, average life expectancy in America went up 11 years, but it has gone up. Now, you might take from that people are getting older than they used to get. That's not exactly true. What it actually does tell us is that many, many people died before they got old. A lot of babies didn't get very old. A lot of children died. A lot of people died of diseases that immunization now has wiped out. Even sicknesses that are capable of bringing death, thanks to modern medicine, are much more controllable, like pneumonia, heart disease, and cancer. But I had to think, what does this change in life expectancy do to people's concept of life as life moves on? I think we probably don't expect to die like people did at one time. I don't know if they expected to die, but they knew it was much more a probability or a possibility. People say at one time, life-threatening or disease was a little bit like the weather. It could change without warning. A good example is George Washington, who developed a throat infection on December 13, 1799, that killed him by the next evening. We don't quite know what that's like. And yes, people definitely still do die without warning, but the point is not as much as they did at one time. So lifespan expectancy has gone up, but not lifespan guarantee. We tend to put those two together, but they're not. Number two, being elderly is not revered as it once was. Now, I'd like to think in our circles that's not quite true like it is in the world, but just listen to this. They say that demographers, that's the people that take the census of the people that are alive, have always known that people tend to lie about their ages, okay? And at one time, like in the past, it was so customary for many people to state their age higher than they were that these demographers would kind of figure that in, you know what I mean? Because so many people wanted to appear older than they were. And that was because there was status, there was respect for older age. Today, it's the other way. These demographers have come up with methods to alter that figure because so many people lie about their age younger. They say they're younger than they actually are. They understate their ages. So old age, which was once rare, it's more rare to get old, is now commonplace. Furthermore, because of massive advances in technology, the learned have the answers instead of the experienced. Okay? The learned have the answers instead of the experienced. Think with me. At one time, Grandpa had the answers. If you had a question about life, you went to the one with the most experience, okay? Because Grandpa knew how to fix things, he knew how to make things, he had stories to tell of what happened long ago. Grandpa was respected for his age and experience. Today, if you want to know something, you Google it. You look it up on YouTube and watch somebody show you how to do it, or you look it up on Pinterest. And if that all fails, you can always go on your WhatsApp group and you'll soon have somebody offering you an answer. But it won't be Grandpa because he doesn't have WhatsApp. It'll be somebody younger, probably. And of course, if your computer is giving you trouble, you ask your teenager how to fix it. And they usually can. So the society tends to feel like they do not need the elderly like they did at one time. Point number three, these realities have created changes in the relationships between the young and the old. Whether Grandpa and Grandma lived in the next door in the Doughty house, or the one surviving of them lived in the back, little back bedroom in the floor of the farmhouse there, they depended on the family for some things, and the family depended on them for some things. I remember shelling peas with my grandma. She lived across the pasture. But then down the road, a farmer got a pea hauler. And that was the end of shelling peas with grandma. See, that's how that works. So the point is that many changes have brought about a shift from interdependence, which is depending on each other, to independence, which is not needing each other as much. Family units in the past depended on each other, on each person of the unit, but today we tend to live more independently. And we tend to blame the up-and-coming generation. We tend to blame the young people for that. But I don't think that's quite fair, because I believe that the drive in man to improve on the past is a God-given gift. If not, then we should be living the same way they did 5,000 years ago. We shouldn't have changed anything. So we can thank modern technology and modern conveniences, advanced healthcare, for giving to our elderly independence that at one time they may not have had. And I think they truly enjoy that. Just ask them which one of these conveniences they'd like to do without. Or ask your aging parent as they get older what they'd like to do. Would they like to move in with one of the children? And they say, oh no, I don't want to be a bother to them. See, they like their independence too. Well, how about a nursing home? Well, no, they'll want to eat breakfast at 7 o'clock and I don't want to eat till 9 o'clock. See, they want their independence too. So this is where we've come to. So we like our independence, even though independence has brought a change in our relationships. But the big problem with liking independence is, what do you do when it's no longer feasible? What do you do when the changes in a person's life take that independence away? It's no longer an option. So heading number three, part number three, I've entitled Facing the Challenges of Declining Health. And I face this part of the message with a little bit of trepidation because I know that declining health is a very negative subject. And I don't want to make the whole sermon negative. I hope not to end it that way. Furthermore, every situation is different, and to stand up and give all the answers is an impossibility. And I believe one of the facts is that as we experience poor health or declining health, it's easy to feel like no one understands. And it's hard for the ones that still have good health to relate to the one who has declining health. But this thing of declining health is a very real thing for us. It's something that we will face. For some, the window of declining health may be very narrow. Dying of a heart attack, an unexpected heart attack, gives you a very narrow window of declining health. But for many, declining health can take a long time. So point number one under this heading I have, accept that declining health will happen to each one of us. It's good for us to think about this, because unless the Lord returns while we are yet young and haven't faced declining health, we certainly will face declining health. So for the sake of our topic tonight, let's just accept the fact that we can all expect sometime to experience declining health. Now, someone has described aging and dying before many of the medical advancements we take for granted as falling off a cliff. A person was getting older and some of their body was deteriorating, but all at once they were gone. You got a message, so-and-so passed away. No frills, no messing around, that's the way it was. Their bodies may have been declining, but you kind of took that as old age, but all of a sudden they passed on. But today, modern medicine has come up with many ways to alleviate or make easier to endure or lessen many of these bodily deteriorations. We do surgery for this, and we have a procedure for that. We replace this or take medication for that. We change our diet for another thing. But none of this does anything to stop the aging process. We cannot stop the aging process. It continues to happen to us. But because of these things that are done to alleviate the symptoms, all right, or to temporarily fix things, the ride to death, instead of a drop off a cliff, becomes a bumpy road down the mountain. Every time something happens, we know what to do about it. We go to the doctor. We take care of that, and we revive that person. And they go a little bit more, and then there's another calamity, another thing they face, and they go down. This bumpy ride just continues down the mountain. And the unfortunate thing is that for those with terminal illness, the treatments that are needed for each of these bumps can easily become more expensive, more complex, and more traumatic. I know you all heard stories about someone who faced an operation and they didn't survive. Or maybe they did survive, but they were never the same. The treatment meant to extend their life didn't give them the quality of life that everybody hoped it would. Matter of fact, it may have given them less quality than they envisioned or desired. But the point is, we need to accept the reality of declining health. Number two, understand that everyone needs a reason to live. And we know how as health declines, this can become increasingly difficult. Just staying alive is a real job. Nevertheless, studies have proven that as long as possible, people should have something they are responsible for. Someone has said, it's important to have a reason to get out of bed in the morning. I remember some years ago, my wife and I were traveling on business early in the morning. We stopped at a McDonald's to get a little breakfast. And I saw this lady there. I always figured she must have been 80 years old. And she was wiping tables. And beside her stood her walker. There was a lady that early in the morning had found a reason to get out of bed. And she had found a way to be useful. And I think that's wonderful. And I don't think it always has to be a wage-earning job. I know there's individuals that hand out meals in their local hospital. There's people that volunteer places like Christian Aid Ministries or other places like that. I know of one sister that every week she does some baking and cooking for a mother with a lot of little children. And even if these things are too difficult, they say it's still important to have something that you're responsible for. Maybe a pet. I mean, I have a ways to go. I don't need a pet at this point in life. But a pet that's looking to you for its life, for its life. Or maybe even some plants to tend. For life to have meaning, we need to be part of something bigger than ourselves. Something outside of ourselves. And I believe the key word is satisfaction. Ecclesiastes tells us that the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. And I believe it's sweet because he's tired, but I also believe it's sweet because he has found satisfaction in a job well done. And I believe our Creator is that way because it tells us that when he went about to create the world, every day after he did what he did, he stopped and he looked at it and he said, "That's good." I believe God found satisfaction in a job well done. And we are made in his image. And I believe it's very important that we try our best for ourselves and for others, for those that we're working with, the elderly, that we find a way that they can find some satisfaction in life. I think one way that the young can bless the elderly and the strong can bless the weak is by helping with this effort to make them feel useful. I believe something even as simple as visiting someone that's sick, someone that has declining health, it gives that person an opportunity to be part of something bigger than themselves. Something outside of their four walls, something outside of their bed. And if you can let them know and understand that they have blessed you, then you have given that person a small sense of satisfaction for that day. And you will be a source of satisfaction to them. Everyone needs a reason to live. Number three, find the proper balance of autonomy. That's not a word we use much, but autonomy simply means independence or freedom. And as people's health declines, we may need to talk about this. Find the balance of independence or freedom. I've already said that I pity the elderly because their health is failing, their money's running out, and their friends are dying. But the other thing they're losing is their independence. And that's hard. Because I believe it's important to find that proper balance, because what happens as health fails is more care is needed. And so this level of independence becomes a struggle between the one giving the care and the one receiving the care. One person said it this way: we want autonomy, there's that word again, we want autonomy for ourselves, that's independence, and safety for those we love. Many of the things we want for those we care about are things we would adamantly oppose for ourselves because they infringe upon our sense of self. Did you catch that? We can easily put people in a box and that infringes on their sense of self. Loss of independence is a huge detriment to self-worth. And I believe the answer to some of this is the golden rule. If you're the one giving the care, ask yourself, how would I want to be treated if I was the one that needed help? How best can I help this individual without minimizing their self-worth? Sometimes it can become that way. We're impatient, or we don't have the time to help this person, and we minimize their self-worth. If we're the one receiving the help, we can ask ourselves, what can I do to be the kind of person I would enjoy taking care of if I was the caregiver? That's the golden rule. Well, what are some reality checks for a person's independence? I found two classifications in my studies, and I think I'll share them for whatever they're worth. If one cannot shop, prepare food, maintain their housekeeping, do their own laundry, manage their medication, make phone calls, travel on their own, and handle their finances, they lack the capacity to live safely on their own. That's one classification. If one cannot, without assistance, use the toilet, eat, dress, bathe, groom, get out of bed, get out of a chair, and walk, then they lack the capacity for basic independence. So what am I saying? I'm saying that we need to be ready and prepared to put some effort into finding this balance of autonomy, either for ourselves or for our loved ones, as we face declining health. Number four, discuss the hard questions. One doctor said this, in the United States, 25% of all Medicare spending is for the 5% of patients who are in their final year of life, and most of that goes for their care in their last couple months, which is a little apparent benefit. Now, when I read that to you, and rightly so, the first thing you're going to think about is money. And I'm not going to go there tonight to try to figure out how much people can spend on maintaining or trying to keep their life going, trying to maintain health. I think that's a very personal decision, and I don't think there's a blanket decision that can be a formula to give for that. But what I do want us to understand or notice is the fact that most of that care, that medical care, is given in the last couple months of people's lives. And what's the message for us in that? Here's the message, I believe. As the body deteriorates, the medical world has discovered almost endless ways to keep it alive with ever more complex and costly efforts, which eventually are all doomed to fail. See, we are mortal. And so we have to understand that the medical world, because of their knowledge and because of what they can do nowadays, they can keep you going after you're dead. They can make your heart beat there or put you on an artificial heart and keep you going. But death is going to happen to all of us. And that's what we talk about when we say that the medical world today has the ability to almost extend life but remove quality of life. Indeed, in some of these cases, extreme last-ditch efforts to prolong life can even hasten death, actually. I'd like to quote one surgeon that said this, in generations before our own, the necessity of nature's final victory, meaning death, I put that in there, the necessity of nature's final victory was accepted and expected, okay? Doctors were far more willing to recognize the signs of defeat and were far less arrogant about denying them. So in other words, before medicine was so advanced, death was viewed as normal. It was okay. Today, because of all the advancements, death is viewed in the medical world as failure. And we have to understand that. Because of that, the tendency is to go to all measures and all means to win over death, to push it off. And that's why it's important to discuss the hard questions. When is it time to switch from fighting to extend life to fighting instead for what the individual considers to be valuable to them in their last days? Accept the fact that, you know what, I'm going to die. What would I like to do with my last remaining days? Because if continued treatment is not going to give the person what they really want, then we can wonder, why would we do it? And I believe these are very personal decisions, like I said, but I just want to emphasize that I believe that for people that believe the best is yet to come, we need to be careful about choosing to fight to extend life at all costs. Someone compared this to an army general who chooses to fight to the death. He's determined not to give up, and so he fights until his whole army and himself are annihilated. Much better is a general who says, you know what, we're not going to win this thing. Let's be content to surrender. The one loses all he has, and the other one, while not getting what he really wanted, still has some things left. See the difference? So be prepared to discuss the hard questions. Now, we've discussed the medical profession a bit this evening, and we're glad for them. We're blessed to live in the age we do. And in all fairness, their job is to concentrate on the repair of health. That's their job, just like you and I have our jobs. Their job is not the sustenance of the soul. But I'd like to consider that just a little bit yet, so we don't end on a negative note. For part four, I've entitled it simply, Making It Through. We need to remember, it's not just us that's mortal. Every human being is mortal. And for people who don't know the Lord, for people who don't recognize their Creator, they face these things just like we all do. But I believe that for the child of God, we can face these challenges very differently than those people do. Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 32. Isaiah paints some very beautiful word pictures. Isaiah is a big book, and there's a lot to read, but here and there, Isaiah comes up with some very nice things. And Isaiah 32 is one of those places. I'd like to read Isaiah 32, 15 to 18. Until the Spirit be poured upon us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted for a forest, then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. And the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness, and assurance forever. And my people shall dwell in a peaceful habitation, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Did you notice that? Righteousness for the people of God brings peace, quietness, assurance, and rest. This is the hope and the promise that we have. Declining health is not something we anticipate, not something we look forward to. But I believe regardless of what God has in store for each one of us, we have promises that he will be there with us. Skip down to the next chapter, Isaiah 33, 5 and 6. The Lord is exalted, for he dwelleth on high. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness, and wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times. And strength of salvation, the fear of the Lord is his treasure. Recently, my wife and I sat with a family that the husband and father had a meeting with the doctor because he was going to be told that there was nothing more they could do for his failing heart. And when we met for that meeting, family said, first of all, they want to pray before we start because they believe that God is very involved in what's going on there today. So we did. We opened that meeting with prayer. And then the doctor talked and he shared his devastating news. And then he turned it over to his assistant who talked with the family about what they could expect going forward. Remember, we prayed to God at the start of the meeting. And at one point in her little exposition there, I thought she looked at things very, very balanced. She said like this, for people like you, your faith will help you. All right? Now look back at verse 6 of Isaiah. Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times and strength of salvation. That sounded like what she was talking about. The stability of thy times. I was really impressed with that. I don't know, we didn't ask that lady what her faith would do for her, but I believe this is what our faith can do for the people of God. When we face things that are extremely negative, when we face hard decisions, when we face things that we'd rather not talk about, it says the fear of the Lord can be our treasure. One more passage yet in 1 Corinthians, turn to 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul gives us some a real note of victory, I believe. Note of hope. First Corinthians 15, 51 to 58 in closing. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible shall put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. For the child of God, victory lies ahead. There will be a time when declining health and death are annihilated, swallowed up in victory. May we rest in that and may we be faithful so that is our experience. Let's kneel for prayer.